Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
It is my pleasure to introduce to Canando our old friend Michael McCord. Michael has lived and worked in San Francisco Zen Center since 2009, and has also served as the Eno, which is the head of the meditation hall, and also as the cook, Tenzo, at Tassajara. So back in, I think it was 1913, during the summer, a number of us Canando members went on a four-day retreat to Tassajara, and Michael was very gracious in welcoming us and making sure that we were well taken care of. So before finding Zen practice, Michael had some ideas and some aspirations about becoming a Christian minister. He earned his bachelor's degree in theology, and he did work as a volunteer for a nonprofit foundation in Jordan, where he did vocational training for mentally challenged people. In addition to his Zen careers, Michael has had careers in technology and in the banking world before coming to Zen practice. And he was ordained as a Zen priest back in 2014. He was the director of San Francisco Zen Center from 2019 to 2021. And today he is currently the chief financial officer of San Francisco Zen Center, which I imagine is a very challenging job. So good evening, Michael. Welcome to Canando. And do you have a title for your talk tonight?
Yes. The title is Wash Your Bowl. Well, thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Les and Teresa. I came to Canando, I think, back in 13 or 14 in the fall, and the first time I visited the Sangha there. What a lovely group and what a lovely building, and everything down there is just an amazing time. So it's great to be able to connect with you this way via Zoom, and only way that we can connect sometimes these days. So it's great to be here. Back when I think about lessons that I learned growing up that inspire some of the Zen teachings that I have come to life today for me. One of the key thoughts I always comes back is this time in the bathtub with my brother. And what we would do is we would take turns getting in the bathtub in our swim trunks. We'd fill up the bathtub with water, and then we would submerge ourselves and compete to see who could hold their breath the longest. And so this was something that was intensely painful while I was doing it. In fact, every single second that I was underwater, I had this sense that I cannot wait until this is over. And it will be so nice when I can breathe air again. But I was holding out for that golden prize of how many seconds can I do it? Kind of like banging your head against the wall and then it feels so good to stop, you know? So, It was amazing because for whatever reason, this is something that is so much the way that I was taught to live my life, from accomplishment to accomplishment. And in between, you hold your breath. You know, I don't like what's going on right now, and what's happening right now isn't really my life. But one day I'll live my life. One day I will inherit the life that I want to live. And whether you're a kid that wants to eventually ride a bicycle or eventually wants to get your driver's license or go to high school, then you want to get good grades because you want to get into a good college. You want to get into a good college so that you can have a good career. But then, of course, you want to find a mate and you want to have children, or you want to, you know, put together some finances for the children to be able to go to school. You want to get promoted in the job. You want to sit 10 years of Zazen. You want to maybe go on some retreats at Esalen with your partner so you have good couple relationship. And then your kids need to get into a good college. And then you need to eventually be able to buy the house, and you need to, you know, you never arrive at like, okay, now I'm living my life. Right now, I'm living my life. I'm in high school, I'm living my life. I'm 40 years old, I'm living my life. I'm 60 years old, I'm now living my life. I see people every day go down the street here on Page Street in San Francisco, most of them going to jobs, heading down our sloped street, going down to Market Street to go into the tech jobs on their bicycles and scooters and skateboards and automobiles. And they're all going somewhere, and they're all going to go do something. And I wonder sometimes when I see each person, I'm like, do you feel like right now I'm living my life, I've arrived? Or is it about getting something, about arriving somewhere? When will I arrive? Like they always have children in the back seat of a car going to a trip somewhere. When are we there yet? When are we going to get there? Am I holding my breath? Am I holding my breath in Buddhist practice? One day I will be a Buddhist practitioner who is calm and serene and wise and connected and settled. And I have the mundane moments in life catch on fire like Thich Nhat Hanh talks about. And I can be serene in the middle of a tornado and a storm. And I can be in the, then when that happens, I will be living my life as a Buddhist practitioner. I will get there someday. You know, I think that in the adult world, the time that it really is most apparent to me that I have to struggle with this in an overt sense is when I go to a restaurant that I like and the table is not ready yet. And so I'm sitting there in the waiting room, very symbolically like the waiting room of life. I'm waiting to live my life. I can see the people eating that wonderful food and I can smell it. It's almost like really teasing you. And you can see all the other people getting their food, and I'm in the waiting room. Does that moment count? Am I alive in that moment in the waiting room? Can I be alive in the waiting room? Or do I skip over that? Do I hold my breath in the waiting room? And one day I will be able to then live my life in the restaurant. Dogen, the founder of this school of Zen, has something he says about making a fine cream soup that I really like. And the Tenzo Kyokun is his instructions to the cook. We chant it every morning in the Zen kitchen. And it's how to engage with things. It's the engagement practice. The most engagement practice you have in the Zen monasteries in the kitchen. You have all these deadlines and where you have all these intersections of, you know, you have destinations you're trying to get at, but you also need to do it in a certain way and not be thinking about when it's done or how beautiful it is. It's actually doing the thing that's in front of you, whether it is mundane ingredients or something that's a fine cream soup. And this is from the Tenzo Kyokun. He says, if you have wild grasses with which to make a broth, do not disdain them. If you have ingredients for a creamy soup, do not be delighted. Where there is no attachment, there can be no aversion. Do not be careless with poor ingredients, and do not depend on fine ingredients to do your work for you, but work with everything with the same sincerity. If you do not do so, then it is like changing your behavior according to the status of the person you meet. All of these practices that we do have there are lessons about our interpersonal relationships, about our sangha, about the way in which we interact with the people around us, and noticing that we have attraction and aversion, nothing wrong with enjoying a fine cream soup, but are we, when we get that very basic vegetable soup, kind of waiting, well, okay, we'll make it through this meal, but boy, it'd be really nice tomorrow. We'll make that fine cream soup. We're in that conversation with that person that we don't find to be that interesting. We're like, okay, I'll get through this conversation, but I can't wait till I talk to so-and-so. They're fun. But yeah, I'll get through this conversation. All seconds matter, even this one. Because as a central tenet of Buddhism, we suffer because of how we hold our suffering and engage our suffering. And we do it in a way that does not let it subside, but perpetuates more suffering. And the very existence of a desire to have the suffering subside creates a clinging to an idea that then causes more suffering. The very existence of a desire to have the suffering subside. If I am there in Zazen, and I feel like I am suffering because my nose is itching, and where I'm going is the desire for that nose to quit itching, then I am suffering and propelling that suffering. But how can you be there with your nose itching? That's difficult. That's no fun. Or your knee feeling stiff. Have you ever sat in a place that has bugs that get into the zendo? But we at Tassajara have bugs that in the summer and fall get into the zendo. And there is nothing like sitting in this school, which we call this school the school of immovable sitting. We create this construct that we sit in, and it's a construct, and it allows us to see ourselves. And in this construct, we're sitting, and we call it the school of immovable sitting, not because if we're doing damage to our body, we can't move. Of course, you would need to move if you feel like you're doing damage to your body, but if it's just merely annoyance or impatience, we just sit through it. And sometimes those bugs would come through the window. And there's nothing like having a little tiny bug crawl across your face. And you think to yourself, wow, I can't wait until this bug leaves. When is this bug going to leave? Maybe I can flex my cheek a little bit and that bug will leave. Or can I sit there with what's happening and actually be with the moment? Just be with what's happening. Be with the entire phenomenon of what is unfolding right in front of me. Rather than clinging to an idea of, I think that I will be happy when what is currently happening stops happening. I'm clinging to an idea, and this idea is actually causing more suffering. And it's interesting to just learn to be with the phenomenon as it is arising. And to say that I never brushed a bug away from my face would be lying. But I have had some occasions to not do that. And if you have ever sat with, of course, not scratching your nose, you know what that is like too. But this is something that in these very simple examples spill out into the big things in our life, where we know that we want something to stop happening. We want something to quit happening in our lives. And there's nothing wrong with taking action. There's nothing wrong with outside of the construct, because this construct is where we do our practice. We're practicing. We're practicing for daily life. But how do we get the clarity to be able to know what action to take? It is by being able to be in a place that is able to let go of the idea of what necessarily should happen, and that right now this suffering shouldn't be happening, and when it stops, I will then get back to the Zen stuff of sitting and enjoy my Zazen. Because the nose itching is as much a part of my Zazen and beautiful Zazen as sitting there when I'm counting my breath and it just seems to be going really well that morning. There's an author that I often find quotes from, And I went back and actually realized I quoted the same author last time I was here, but it was a different quote. So, Maria Mariner Rilke is one of my favorite authors. And Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, Rilke had an amazing insight about the human condition that in many cases is so in alignment with our Buddhist practice. And this is something that Rilke says about suffering. Why do you want to shut out of your life any uneasiness, any misery, any depression, since after all, you don't know what work these conditions are doing inside you? Why do you want to persecute yourself with the question of where all this is coming from and where it's going? Since you know, after all, that you are in the midst of transitions and you wished for nothing so much as to change. If there's anything unhealthy in your reactions, just bear in mind that sickness is the means by which an organism frees itself from what is alien. So one must simply help it to be sick and to have its whole sickness and to break out with it, since that is the way it gets better. You know, they've noticed after surgery for a long period of time, they used to do everything they could to reduce inflammation and give people medications that would reduce inflammation. And then in recent years, they've come to realize that some of the inflammation actually is necessary for bones to knit back together correctly and for the tendons and ligaments to really heal and to create strong ligaments and tendons. And that some of that inflammation that we were taking away is actually keeping things from healing and from knitting and from becoming what it should be. And this is so symbolic of what it is that we're doing with our Zen practice. It's how do we be with the things that we cannot control in a way that allows them to morph and integrate into something that is more wholesome in the future and that we become stronger through. And so the question that's always in front of us is this question: how do we break the circle of suffering without clinging to a desire to break the circle? How do we break the circle of suffering without clinging to the desire to break the circle? Well, firstly, we don't focus on the subsiding. The focus is not on when will this end. There is nothing that will torment children more in the back of a car on a long trip than to sit there and to constantly be thinking about, are we there yet? If they have other things to focus on and to be with, that certainly helps. But when we can abandon when, and we can be with the now, we start to break that circle. And the way that we engage is more like a curious scientist watching the experiment unfold. You know, a scientist that's not a good scientist has an idea of how the experiment should go, how long it should necessarily take, when we'll get the results, and probably the ballpark of what the results will be. But in order to really do a good experiment, a scientist has to try to divorce themselves from as much context as possible, to try to be as much of a beginner as possible, to have the least amount of idea about what is going to actually happen and what the answer is going to be, and to let the experiment unfold, knowing that the things that might be learned through that process will be much greater, because what we're getting at there is what is happening. We're looking to prove or to find what is real and not to prove or reify our truth. But to really be that open. And realizing that in our everyday life, what I consider to be suffering is held in a context of what I have defined as suffering in regard to an experience. But what is a new type of enjoyable? I mean, we all know what an enjoyment is like and how it is migrated through our lives as we've grown up and developed new context for enjoyment. If you were 4 years old and you put a plate in front of you with a big pile of colored sugar, and you gave yourself the choice of eating that or a very nice souffle that was elegantly crafted with great foam on top and a superb reduction of mushroom. Now, you give that option to a four-year-old, and they're going to go for the pile of sugar. The capacity to actually enjoy and to understand and have a context for what is happening has not developed yet. And so if I am stuck in my circle of clinging for what even enjoyment or even relief of suffering will look like on the other side, I might miss it when it passes me by. I might not be in a place because I've got too much of an idea of what it will be like when I quit holding my breath. That is what it will be like when this trial is over. That is what it will be like when I finally have a good relationship with so-and-so. That is what it will be like when my work life takes off. That is what it will be like when I become a really, really polished Zen practitioner. These ideas might actually steal the vision from us for what the truth is when it comes by us. A new type of enjoyable. It's like trying to describe to somebody who has never seen a liquid what water is like. What is out there that I haven't seen yet? Our capacities for understanding only evolve in the now. Our capacities for understanding only evolve in the now. And there are many states of being that I have never seen before, and it's like describing water to me. I'm hearing the words, but it's just going somewhere else. How can I be in a situation that is chaotic and seemingly unhappy and full of suffering, and maybe not enjoying that situation, but being also centered and really grounded inside? What is that like? What is it like to have different tools in our tool belt? What if you were back in the 19th century and you had a tool belt literally, and you were going to a construction site, but you only had 19th century tools? You couldn't conceive what it would be like to have a power drill with you. These things exist, and the human experience is limitless. But if I have too much of an idea of what the cessation of suffering will be, then it might keep me from actually ever having a new context with which to hold my experiences. It's like if you've never been a runner before and you talk to someone who's a runner and they tell you all the ways in which they experience being a runner, being out of breath, sweating, maybe their legs hurt. And then they say, but there is a bit of a runner's high that you get and from an endorphin rush. You think, that sounds terrible. Why would I ever run? You know, okay, you get outside, but, and that there's people that every day they can't wait to get and do their run. And other people might consider that suffering. So much of this is contextual around what it is that we consider to be human experience. There is a school called the Yogacara school that you might have heard of. It's part of the Mahayana evolution of thought. The Mahayana is the Buddhist school that Zen is a part of. And in the first century BCE, there was this sutra that was written that fired this school called the Yogacara school that really kind of took off in the third and fourth centuries. And it has a lot to do with human experience. And the Yogacara school is in many cases known as the mind-only school. It's kind of a radical human experience as everything is basically coming from our mind. every object, every person, every experience is actually coming from my mind. Very radical way of viewing the universe. And this sutra, that was one of the founding sutras that eventually ended up with that school, is called the Sutra on the Samadhi for Encountering Face-to-Face the Buddhas of the Present. They weren't into short titles. And so this sutra, also called in Sanskrit, it's Pratyutpana Samadhi Sutra, the Sutra on the Samadhi for Encountering Face-to-Face the Buddhas of the Present. Very short quote, probably about as short as that title. This or whatever belongs to this triple world is nothing but mind or thought. Why? Because however I imagine things, that is how they appear. Why? Because however I imagine things, that is how they appear. Right now I'm looking at my monitor, and my monitor has a black border around it. The border around my monitor is black. Now, if I take that same monitor into a light with a red infrared wavelength, it will not look black. It will look very different. It might even look purple. And if I take it to Mars with the way that the sunlight and the atmosphere in Mars looks, it will look very different than it looks now. And if I look at that monitor through the eye of a fly, it will look very different than it looks now. The only reason that I think that it is a specific fixed color is because of the wavelength of the universe and this room and what I'm used to calling black. In the mind-only school, they start to get into this in a way that it starts to not seem quite as radical, because we realize that how this black seems to me is really dependent upon my context. Our eyes have filters for light, but nothing actually has a true color. Now, what if you as a superpower could see a shade of green that nobody else could see? There's no way you could ever tell anybody about your superpower, and you probably would never know that you had that superpower. Because every time you described that shiny sort of glossy emerald green that nobody else can see, you would just call it green, and you would call it emerald green, and everybody else would say, yeah, we can see emerald green, and then that would be that. But we know from experience that some people are actually colorblind, and other people see colors in a little bit different way, even as human beings. Talk to a brother or a sister about a family. How was our family growing up? You're going to get a very different story. Talk to your parents about how the family was, how I was growing up. You're going to get a very different story. They were there looking at the same monitor, calling it black, but they had a different version and a different definition of black. And people around us have all sorts of superpowers. How they see love, how they see contentment, how they see settled, wise. There are all these different versions of the universe that are going on around us at all the time. We are projecting out things that are based on everything from our neurobiology to transformative things that happened in our life when we were 4 and 7 to things we inherited from our great-grandmother. Millions and billions of causes and conditions coming together to create one single moment of consciousness. And it's a very unique consciousness. And my suffering is in the context of that consciousness in that moment and how I'm holding it. I had this experience recently, a very real surface level suffering around sitting with an N95 mask in the Zendo. Now, we have been sitting with N95 masks in the Zendo for some period of time, I think a year. And I had a friend who has a science background, and they were talking about not being able to, when they got their mask on correctly, being able to get enough CO2 out of their mask to not mildly hyperventilate when they were actually sitting zazen and they were having a hard time sitting. Now, up until my friend told me that, I never had a problem sitting with an N95 mask. But ever since then, I have to watch myself from getting too far into like going over that cliff, because there's been a few times where I've even taken my mask off briefly and taken a few deep breaths because I'm starting to like hyperventilate. Now, that didn't happen for an entire year, but they put that seed in my mind. And there's been some very real suffering around that. Totally mind created. There are things that we do that perpetuate our story. And what we want to do is we want to be able to break out of our story. And it's not that things don't happen to us. It's not that there are, the universe is inherently unfair around all sorts of things. And you can watch the news and read about unfair things that happen to people every single day. But how do I hold these things when they happen? If I can get into the mind-only school in some sort of way, it actually, I find, helps me hold things a little bit more loosely and less from a knee-jerk reaction of why did this happen to me? And more a matter of this is a phenomenon that's happening right now and that my suffering has a lens. And I can more easily start to let go of the surety of my suffering. And it's just the phenomenon of now, but it is not a fixed property. How do I hold things? How do I hold things? We're all taught how to hold things when we grow up. We all grow up in a culture, in a family culture, a city culture, a village culture. We're taught how to hold things. How do we hold things when we're happy, when we're sad, when we're depressed? We're taught these things, even with our birth order and with our gender and with our ways in which people viewed us. We are taught how to hold things. How we hold things is so huge. There's this phrase, bear your burden nobly, which I always enjoyed, because it's like to be a human being means that there will be some suffering. But can I bear that burden nobly? And how do you bear it? It's like a thousand little tiny knobs on like a soundboard. It's like a little bit up and a little bit down. It's like, how do you describe it? Well, that's why we have warm hand to warm hand in this school, where you learn from a teacher and you just notice the way that the teacher goes through these things and how they work with situations. It's very hard to describe. It's like, well, how do you deal with X situation that's incredibly complex and emotionally fraught? And you notice how the teacher works with these things. And you notice the attitude and the perspective and the tone. My ordination teacher and teacher is Ryushin Paul Haller. And I can remember when I decided that I wanted to ask him to be my teacher. I was at a class at San Francisco Zen Center in the summer of 2009. And he gave this class that I thought was brilliant. It was just a brilliant class. And then we had Q&A afterward. And I had all these different thoughts that I wanted to ask him about. But the first two or three students that asked him a question were actually quite critical of his class and were asking really sort of pedantic, not so necessary questions, often tangents and quibbling over little tiny. And it really, I found it annoying. And I thought, I hope Paul, you know, really kind of like says, you know, this isn't so important. And come on, this is the essence of what I was saying. That's not what I was saying. You know, I wanted to see him set them straight, you know. And of course, Paul didn't do that. He answered their questions like the questions were the most brilliant questions. And he made the people feel like it was good that they were there and that they had the courage to raise their hand. Now, it would have been very difficult for me to have written and learned that from a paragraph. But the warm hand to warm hand of seeing it demonstrated, of meeting people where they are at and being right there with them, was a very powerful teaching for me. How do we bear our burden? Do we bear it nobly? Do we bear it in a way that is nuanced, like that soundboard where we learn how we kind of want all the keys to be? It's very hard to learn by ourselves, but we learn it from Sangha, we learn it from examples in our life, and we learn it from our teachers. And learning to look for those teachings, learning to look for those ways, how do I deal with this situation? How do I hold my burden? How do I work through a difficult thing? And learning that we don't need to add. We don't need to escape this moment. We don't need to run away from what's happening now. That the itching on the nose and the sitting in a zazen posture, that can be enough. Learning to just let things be enough. And the present moment, as we started out with, catching on fire, the mundane becoming splashed with technicolor, isn't a achievement that is strived for, but it's a place that you notice in your rearview mirror that somehow or another you've started to come across. We don't think about the subsiding of suffering, but the fruits of practice will start to grow up around us. We don't choose when or how or what they will look like. But being able to just be with what is and letting that be enough and not having to run away from it or wish it away. I noticed at one point in time, a few years ago, even here at Zen Center, that I wasn't ever just eating my dinner. I live alone in an apartment next to Zen Center. And I think I was just not liking eating dinner alone. And so I would always eat dinner and listen to music. I would always eat dinner and read the newspaper. I would eat dinner and listen to a podcast. And I just decided I'm just going to sit there with my plate of food and just eat dinner and not talk. And then most of you, probably many of you have probably experienced Orioki, the meditation when you eat, and just learning to have eating as a meditation, letting that be enough. And not creating something where we're wishing away the current moment, where we have to add something to this moment, where we're thinking of when will I be done washing the dishes so I can get back to the interesting thing. If we were able to choose how and when something subsided, it likely would rob us of what lessons could be learned and what deeper footing might be laid down for taller growth. Being able to hold what we'd be inclined to reject loosely, because those answers come across, those revelations come across, and if we're too busy getting away from this moment and trying to distract ourselves from what's happening right now, when the answers come, we might not see them. It's not quiet enough. We can't just engage. And so taking things off of the cushion, like we always say, into small ways in our life. And it's still hard for me to do the dishes without thinking about a whole bunch of other things. And I want to put on NPR, and I want to tell Alexa to play my favorite song. And I want to, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it is also a great opportunity to just do dishes. To just do dishes. And when I'm doing them, not think about all the stuff that happened today. To actually think about the dish. To think about the soap. To think about the sponge. How much water I'm using. And that plate. And to not daydream about where I got the plate and what that store was like. And there was that other stack of plates. And just that plate. That plate in that sink. And letting that be enough. Because as we try to learn how to escape what's going on, if that's a compulsion, if it's a desire that we need to take away or add something from this moment, that is where we get back into the circle of suffering. We see people all the time that are trapped in a story. So am I. It can take time to realize, because it can take time to realize what it is that we're doing, and it can take time to realize what's actually happening in front of us, because impatient pragmatism robs us of the unfolding. If I feel like, okay, this seems logical to me right now, this is what's happening, this is what's going on, I've got it all sussed, being pragmatic about things, being logical. And everything that doesn't seem logical or makes sense to me in the moment right now, I don't hold loosely and let germinate and sit on the back burner, then things can't really unfold over time. And so in Zazen, we sit and our nose itches and we let that be all that's happening right now. And we let that be enough. And we don't escape from it. And we don't wish it away. We just make the bed and nothing more. One of my favorite koans is Joshi washes the bowl. And I want to end with this. A monk asked Zaoshu to teach him. Zaoshu asked, "Have you eaten your meal?" And the monk replied, "Yes, I have." "Then go wash your bowl," said Zaoshu. And at that moment, the monk was enlightened.
A few years ago, I was planning a big party for my husband. It was a momentous occasion for him, and people offered to help, and I said, no, I'm going to do it all myself. And I was running around like crazy and cleaning the house, buying food, just crazy. Anyway, my husband said to me, "You know what? This is not fun." And I said to him, "We'll have fun after the party." And somehow, you know, I think back to that, and I still haven't learned that lesson completely. I still get caught up in, "We will have fun after the party." But it was kind of, and I had not started practicing Zen. This was like 30 years ago. But that often comes back to me about, "We will have fun after the party." And I think a lot of us live our life like that. So you brought that to mind again, Michael. Thank you for that.
That's great, Diane. I'm going to remember that one. That's a line to quote. "We'll have fun after the party." Yeah.
I have a question. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Brenda.
We met many years ago at Tassajara.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So my question is, you know, trying not to change the moment and, you know, accept the moment. And then, you know, there's also times when you notice something that could be done differently or better, or progress in the world is also determined by people who said, this isn't really a productive way of doing it, let me try it this way. And so how do you tell the difference between the growth that's beneficial from accepting things as they are, and maybe they could be a little better too?
Yeah. Well, I think that you're getting right at the heart of it, Brenda, because The whole purpose of having a practice is to be able to live a life. To be able to engage with people around us. Now, oftentimes, we don't take enough time to actually calm and settle and do things one at a time so that we have clarity, so that we know how to act, so that we know how to engage. To cultivate a certain mind that allows us to have the wisdom to know how to jump into a situation or not. I mean, so much of our life is spent of whether I go forward or I don't, you know, do I say something? Do I not, you know? And, Buddhism is not passive. It does not say, just sit at the wall and just accept everything as the world burns down around you. That's not, what Buddhism is teaching us. But what Buddhism is trying to point at is the fact that so much of the time we are engaged in not accepting what's going on inside ourselves. We're not accepting what's going on inside of other people. And we're wound in a way that we can't really see what's actually happening with ourselves, with people around us. And we're doing a lot of things that we think are actually making a difference in the world, and it's actually causing harm, you know. So it's trying to let people be able to cultivate some deeper growths so that they can hold what is happening in a moment and be able to respond. I mean, you know what it's like when you're agitated and your emotional reservoir is full. It's really hard to be able to clearly see and be there for the people around you. They kind of need to behave well or else it's really going to bother you, you know? But if you're in a space where you yourself are centered and you yourself are somewhat calm inside, and if you have some sort of clarity about what's arising for you and you've been in touch with that, you're just more spacious with the people around you. You can hear them better. There's more room for them to make mistakes. And the clarity of how to take action and when to take action starts to sharpen. But we usually take, I think they said people make 30,000 decisions a day or something like that. I mean, little tiny micro things of, you know, how far I turn on the water faucet and whether or not I close the door. And, you know, I mean, just like we're constantly deciding how the universe should be. And this is cultivating a practice that allows us to actually start to see a little more deeply about what's going on so that we can engage.
Thank you.
Lee, yeah, thank you, Brenda. Lee, did you have your hand up?
It's Omar, not Lee. So I'm using her computer. We've been on a lazy Susan, so we swivel back and forth. It's kind of fun. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. Yourself?
All right. So thank you for this talk, and thank you for your presence, number one. And number two, I wanted to say to you that, you know, your talk triggered something in my mind. It opened up the insight that all the ideas that we have actually come from the outside. They've been given to us by other people, and we carry around them. You know, we carry our training, our whatever it is. You know, we go to school and say, oh, how many kids, how many wives, how many husbands, whatever you want to do in life, how many cars, how many experiences, and, but what happens is something fades and we come to this practice. And when we come to this practice, I don't know about other people, what I've started doing is I start from, it's like, okay, how can I go from happiness or joy and move outward? It's not anymore about, oh, you know, this will happen or that will happen. It's like, okay, whatever happens, whatever comes. But something is going to come, no matter what I do. It'll be good, it'll be bad, it'll be, I can put quantifiers and qualifiers and everything, and it'll be this way and that way. But what really comes to me is, let's start with joy and see where this goes, where this takes us. Why not start with joy? There is nothing else left after that. But it got me thinking about what you were saying, that yes, all the ideas that we can carry around during the day, even washing dishes, and when we go away from the dish without looking at the beautiful design on the dish or how beautiful the lacquer on the dish is, it's just like, takes us away because we're too concerned with what is going on or what somebody said and all that stuff. But I just keep on bringing myself back to the joy and say, okay, come back to happiness, come back to joy. That's all you can do. There is nothing else. So thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
Sure.
I like your lazy Susan. That's superb. I've never seen that. You could have a whole meeting that way with 8 or 9 people.
True. I wanted to say something to expand on what Umar just was saying. Is that I think in the last few years, what's happened for me in sitting that has for me been very positive, is that I'll find myself, my mind going away. But when I bring it back, I just imagine that I'm sitting with everything. I'm sitting with all beings. I'm sitting with the trees outside the window. I'm sitting with the other people in the Zendo and the people who live in the houses nearby. I just kind of let that expansive feeling come in. And that has really helped me. So I wanted to share that.
Yeah. No, thank you. I think it's very powerful to notice what it is that helps us let go of our clinging to something that we want and give us a more expansive view. I had an experience, I think it was last year, that it was a beautiful moment. And I try to think about this, but it's kind of like you find your own little koans in life, you know, that kind of open things up for you. And so I love avocados. I love them. And we don't always have them at Zen Center, but sometimes we do have them at Zen Center for salad toppings. And you get to the toppings section after you get your food. So you get in line, and as you're getting your food, you can see the other people that are already getting their toppings on the salad. And sometimes when I'm late to lunch, I'm really hoping that if it's an avocado day, that all the avocado isn't gone by the time I get to the avocados, you know. So I'm there and I've got my tray and I've got my bowl of soup and I've got my salad. I got a nice soup and I've got my salad, or I've got my rice and I'm about to go get my salad. I get over to the salad and someone is taking the last bit of avocado. And they've already got a lot of avocado on their salad, but they're actually taking more avocado. And this is, and I noticed that there's like some mild aggression inside me, kind of like, I'd kind of like to say something to that person about like, aren't you a Buddhist? And don't you already have enough avocado? And are you clinging to your, and I realize how much I'm clinging. And for whatever reason, this one day when this was happening, it shifted my mind about how lucky I am to be living in the country that I am, with the food that I have. I'm sitting there with a bowl of great soup. I've got a plate of rice. And right across the room, I imagined 5 children from a country where you don't get lunch every day, and you might not even get dinner, and you don't know where the next meal is even going to come from. 4 or 5-year-old kids, you know, cute little kids. And they're just looking at me like, are we going to get lunch too? There was something in that that for me just shifted all of my clinging to the how privileged I am, to how ungrateful I am. I've got soup. I've got rice. I even have salad without avocado. Can't that be enough? But yet I'm actually feeling something inside that resembles mild anger toward a person that took too much avocado. noticing the places in life where we have the clinging and what it is that shifts, like what you were just saying about the expansive mind that steps out of our small clinging and gets to something that's bigger. I think that's at the heart of our practice, you know? That's at the heart of our practice, where we can actually be with the people around us and their life and get out of our little world, according to Michael. And from there, our suffering starts to abate. I didn't feel anger toward that person anymore. That was gone, completely gone. No more anger. Boy, it does make me want some guacamole, though. Marie Christine?
You were just reminding me, I recently was reminded of a quote that I think is from Viktor Frankl, that it's in between the stimulus and our response that lies our freedom. And this space that happens is... it's like being in a different dimension of some sort and getting a check on everything. And I feel that happens in so many ways. And I'm not a musician, but I know that, you know, the space between notes is where true music happens. And the space between dance moves is where the beauty shows. So I just thought, you know, it's kind of a symbol of what we're looking at here with our sitting. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up Viktor Frankl. He goes hand in hand with everything here, with his, you know, man's search for meaning. And that seminal thought that he had that he realized, I mean, you really can't get more, let's say, oppressed than to be in a place like where he was when he wrote Logotherapy or came up with it, you know, in a concentration camp. And he said he realized that his freedom was how he responded to the next moment. That, you know, that couldn't be taken away from him. That how he responded to the next moment was his freedom. And, you know, where we put our mind, what we focus on, how we hold our burden, you know, it's amazing some of the things that people start to understand in very, very difficult places of suffering. The power that we've kind of skipped over or not even really looked at that we have. There's so much there, but thank you, Marie Christine, for bringing Viktor Frankl into the room here. Teresa?
Hi, Michael. Thank you for your talk.
Hi, Teresa.
I was thinking about the title of your talk, Wash Your Bowl. And then you just made a brief reference to the title at the end about the Koan you liked. And I've been thinking about what you said. So I thought, oh, maybe the whole talk was about that, about just washing your bowl is what you just said, taking care of the next moment. But this is just my interpretation. I would like to hear a little bit more about, you know, what that koan means for you and if your talk indeed was just about that. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you. That is for me, kind of the synopsis is that koan, where a monk is going to a monastery. So you go to a monastery and you think, you know, I'm going to this place where all these wise people are and they've got all these teachings and they're going to teach me, you know, all these deep teachings. you know. And so he goes to his teacher and he says, you know, I want to be taught about, you know, Zen, please teach me, you know. And then the teacher says, have you had lunch? And he says, yes, I have. And he says, then wash your bowl. And then he was enlightened. And, you know, the moments that we go through in life are beset by all sorts of stories, things that I have about the monastery. What am I going to learn here? What's the master going to teach me? What is it going to be like? Am I going to be a good student? And other people's stories and my stories about their stories. And what is it to just be with, you know, my nose itching and it doesn't need to subside. It doesn't need to subside. I'm just going to be here with this experience, with what's going on. It is symbolic of something that's greater than us than we can't control. It's not saying that if I have my hand on a hot stove, I don't take my hand off. But there are so many things in life that we can't control, and the ways that we practice with them, and the things that we think we can control, that's a whole other big question mark. But the but Zhaozhou is teaching this lesson of when it comes to the essence of Zen, and many people have pointed to this koan as the essence of Zen, that doing the next thing as though it was the most important thing on the planet to do wholeheartedly with my entire intention. Because I can make my bed and then be done and be like, oh, I don't even remember making my bed. Or I can actually just be with me in the bed and me in the comforter and me in the pillows and me in everything. And that's all that's there. And I'm just with me in the bed. And then I'm there with that dish. And learning to just let that be enough so that then when I'm with people, I'm not constantly discerning and thinking, I want to be with that fun person. I want to be with that interesting person. I want to be with that person that makes me, you know, can I be with everyone? Can I be with all the dishes? Can I be with all the tasks? Can I just be with the next thing the way that Paul was with that student who was asking him that kind of annoying, pedantic question and kind of criticizing his talk? And he was just, I'm just going to be right there with this student and meet them. What is this moment asking for? And how can I just be with it and not escape from it, not add anything to it, just do what this moment is asking for? That is the way that the circle is broken from suffering. And so he's trying to point the student back to that at the very end, at the very end of the short koan. But he's trying to point him back to that. He's just saying, wash your bowl. So yes, that is a very long answer, but yes, that was the essence of what I was attempting to unpack.
Maybe you could put something in the chat, Jaya.
Les, you're being quoted.
Yes.
I'm being quoted?
Yeah. She said, Les, in one of his talks, said a key phrase, what next? And I don't know the context of maybe what's happening here.
Yeah.
That sounds like something I'd say. Am I supposed to respond to that, or are you supposed to respond to that?
I don't know. I can come up with all sorts of thoughts about it, but I don't know if I want to spin stories out of context. I don't know what. I mean, I could say what next in the sense of this moment. What is it asking of me? Like I'm in the moment, you know, and what is the moment asking of me, you know? And so how do I respond to this moment? And so every moment has something that it's asking of me. What is the appropriate response? What is the next action? That would be maybe how I would riff on that. But is that, Jaya, is that kind of what you were thinking of, or?
I remember the when Les made that comment in the last, his last lecture. It had to do with instead of if you leave Zazen or leave the Zendo feeling like you did something, you accomplished something admirable, or you were feeling good about yourself. And he was suggesting that kind of like what you were saying, Michael, is wash your bowl. Yeah. What's being asked of me next?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Philip. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than living in the nostalgia of that great Zazen moment, moving on to what the world is asking of me in this moment as I get into my car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very much so. Together, we figured this all out. We got there.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.